right. Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Third Circuit Chapter Conference. It's good to see everybody. My name is Steve Lee, and I'm the president of the Philadelphia chapter. Our chapter is joined today by the Pittsburgh and Harrisburg chapters, the Delaware chapter, as well as the New Jersey chapter. And we're very pleased that you're able to join us for this event focused on education. But it really touches very much on the areas of freedom of thought and individual rights, as you are well aware. We are also very happy to have Professor Robert George as our lunch keynote speaker. He will be discussing what causes and what might cause campus illiberalism. We also have three wonderful panels focusing on racial preferences in education, critical race theory in schools, and school choice. And so let me take a moment to take care of a few brief matters before we get into our panels. First, I want to make sure that we thank the people that have made this event possible. Lisa Ezell, Kate Fugate, Alita Cass, who unfortunately couldn't join us today, Jana Bodor, all from the national office, each of the chapters involved and their leaders, Professor George, the moderators Judge Paul Mady, Judge Joshua Wilson, and Allison Sohn, and each of the panelists who are participating today. Second, I also want to mention CLE. CLE is available for Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. Everyone who pre-registered should have received a course evaluation form as well as the course packet by email. At the end of today's event, to get CLE, you can either take a course evaluation form that's available at the registration desk, fill it out, and submit it at that desk, or you can email it back to Kate at your convenience. Either way works. Lastly, the last kind of logistical issue is there will be an opportunity to ask questions after each panel. Unfortunately, we don't have someone to carry around a mic, but there are two mic stands. So after the panel, the moderator will tell you when it's time for questions. And if you can please go to the mics and ask your questions from there, that would be wonderful. And with that, let's turn to our first panel, Racial Preferences in Higher Education. What are the consequences and what will the Supreme Court do? Moderated by Judge Paul Mady. Judge Mady will introduce the panelists, but let me just start by introducing Judge Mady to you all. Paul Mady is a circuit judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, and he's a longtime friend of the Federalist Society. Prior to his judicial service, Judge Mady was a partner at Lowenstein Sandler, where he practiced complex commercial litigation and criminal justice. He's had a long and storied career. He previously served as senior vice president and general counsel at University Hospital in Newark, an academic medical center and a teaching hospital. Judge Mady also served as deputy chief counsel to Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey and was a longtime assistant United States attorney for the District of New Jersey. He served as a law clerk to two judges, one on the Third Circuit and one in the district court. And he earned his bachelor's from the University of Scranton and his law degree, summa cum laude, from Seton Hall University's School of Law. And so please join me in welcoming Paul Mady, Judge Paul Mady, who will introduce the panelists.
Steve, on behalf of the whole panel, thanks for that kind introduction. Delighted to join so many old friends and so many new leaders here at this event. Steve and I have known each other for a long time since we were both underpaid and overworked government lawyers. I'm glad one of us has come to our senses. Our topic this morning is not new, but it has followed a perhaps most remarkable path, because it has already been 18 years since the Supreme Court announced that we expect that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary in education. Well, with no more than 7 years left on that clock, one might think that the courts, the colleges, the citizens of our country were close to closure. And a glance at the headlines and the head notes tells us otherwise. As the First Circuit recently held in reviewing the challenges to affirmative action at Harvard, no Supreme Court precedent requires colleges to, quote, identify a specific endpoint for the use of race. Rather, it seems in the 43 years since Justice Powell coined the phrase, a diverse student body, It is the language of our debate that has moved from deliberative to breakneck, as old conceptions of remediating past harms are replaced with new notions of intractable racial divides. Consider where we began with Justice Powell reasoning that our future depends on leaders trained through wide exposure to the ideas and mores of students as diverse as this nation, a challenge that he argued depended on the most robust exchange of ideas. Today, exchanging ideas in the classroom is often cause for litigation. And the phrase diverse is used not to refer to a multitude of experiences, but of a singular numeric goal. In 2003, Justice Scalia could dryly write that diversity is not, of course, an educational benefit to, quote, be tested by bar examiners with questions such as, quote, describe in 500 words or less your cross-racial understanding. Well, this year, the American Bar Association proposed just that, outlining new accreditation standards that include training on racism, bias, and, quote, professional identity formation. Much, it seems, remains to be resolved in 7 years. Or perhaps we're just looking at the wrong clock, a point Justice Thomas vigorously and valiantly summarized at that same moment nearly a quarter century ago, exclaiming that it has been nearly 140 years since Frederick Douglass asked the intellectual ancestors of America's educators to just do nothing, a call that led directly to the adoption of the 14th Amendment. So how should we set our watches today? Should we look to the ancient and original guarantees of the Constitution, or have the times taken us to a place where the goals of the framers and the ratifiers, however noble, are no longer necessary and proper for our 21st century republic? Well, we are exceptionally fortunate to have this morning's panel to discuss. We are joined by Ted Shaw, the Julius Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and the Director for the Center of Civil Rights at the University of the North Carolina School of Law. Patrick Strawbridge, a partner at Consovoy McCarthy, and Corey Liu, a partner at Ashcroft Law Firm. We will start with Patrick, turn to Corey, and then Professor, give you the most important final word, after which we'll take your questions. And like you, I am delighted to have the chance to learn from these thinkers. Patrick, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Judge Mady, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting us this morning and for all of you for taking your time out to come and listen to us talk. I hope it will be an illuminating exchange. So as one of the lawyers who basically oversaw the litigation against Harvard as well as some other universities on behalf of Students for Fair Admissions, I thought that I would start by trying to set the table, give you, as brief as I can, background on the litigation, sort of the key points that came out of the litigation, and tee up what's currently before the Supreme Court. As one of the people who've litigated and continue to litigate this case, I'm going to shy away from making any predictions about what the Supreme Court will actually do. I think you can all guess what I hope it does, but that's what the briefs are for. But we'll talk a little bit about how the issues are squared up, and I look forward to a robust exchange with both the panelists as well as the folks here in the room if you have questions. A little bit of background on the lawsuit. The lawsuit was filed in 2014. There were two lawsuits, actually, that were filed, one against Harvard and one against the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. They have proceeded more or less on similar schedules, although we are still awaiting a trial court decision in the Chapel Hill case. It was tried at a bench trial a year ago as of November, so about 11 months ago. But the Harvard case has proceeded to judgment and gone up to the court first. The lawsuits were filed on behalf of Students for Fair Admissions, which is a 501c3 nonprofit. It's a voluntary membership organization. The membership rolls exceed 20,000 individual members, and they brought suit on behalf of their members, who include people who applied to Harvard and did not obtain admission, as well as the parents of future applicants to Harvard. There were a number of actual members of SFFA who were deposed by Harvard in this case about their application to Harvard and their intention to transfer should Harvard stop using race, which is what the standard that the Supreme Court set in the Garotz case for standing to bring an action challenging the use of racial preferences. The complaint alleged a number of counts against Harvard. It included counts that, you know, an attempt to a request that Grutter be overruled, which is obviously something that the First Circuit and the District Court of Massachusetts were unable to provide relief upon. But it also challenged Harvard's use of race under the existing framework set forth under Grutter, whether it could survive strict scrutiny, and some challenges to how Harvard was using race. Was it using it simply as kind of a tiebreaker for close candidates? Was it was there sort of racial balancing going on where it was managing its admissions to reach a certain, you know, composition of the class each year, as opposed to clearly considering individual candidates on their merits? Was race a defining feature of students' applications? And had Harvard conducted a good faith analysis of alternatives to the use of race that it could use to achieve its diversity interests? The lawsuit was put on hold for a while the Supreme Court considered the second iteration of the Fisher case. So there was a stay of about 2 years shortly after the case was filed. That stay lifted in when Fisher 2 came down, which, if my memory serves me right, would have been the end of 2016. Don't quote me on that. You can look at the U.S. reports yourself to get the right date. We then had 2 or 3 years of discovery. In that discovery, SFA took the deposition of 20 employees of Harvard or people associated with the admissions process. A number of SFFA members and leadership was also deposed as part of that. Summary judgment motions were filed in 2018. A summary judgment was denied by the trial court, and so the party proceeded to trial in Boston, Massachusetts, in basically the fall of 2018, and the decision came down the next September. There was a 3-week trial in federal district court. It was a bench trial. Wilmer Hale was on basically took responsibility for defending Harvard. Constable McCarthy, as well as lawyers at Bartlett Beck, tried the case on behalf of SFFA. And some of the sort of most interesting or key evidence that carries over into the cert petition that came out of the trial, I think, can be divided into basically 3 or 4 categories. First of all, there was a lot of discussion of just the general numbers of Harvard's admission. And I think that Corey will probably speak a little bit about some of this, so I won't try to steal too much of his thunder. But the complaint noted that, you know, for the 10 years preceding the filing of the complaint, Harvard's admitted class with respect to Asian Americans had always hovered basically between 18% and 20%. African Americans had hovered between 10% and 12%, and Hispanics, I think, were roughly the same breakdown. And there had been very little movement in those groups during that 10-year period of time. Coincidentally enough, following this lawsuit, Harvard began admitting record numbers of Asian Americans in successive classes, which I'm sure was just an accident and had nothing to do with the fact that it was facing litigation by a group alleging intentional discrimination against Asian Americans. The evidence at trial demonstrated that, at least during its process of admitting applicants, Harvard does get sometimes daily reports on what the current composition of the admitted class is, including the racial composition. And there was testimony by the assistant director of admissions that Harvard would pay attention to those numbers and look for departures, dramatic departures from prior year, and make sure that they weren't having dramatic departures. So there was obviously an argument put forth before the trial court that was impermissible racial balancing. Although Grutter had some similar reports, they were not as frequent, and the results were not as predictable as the Harvard case. There was also, with respect to the allegations of intentional discrimination against Asian American applicants, there was developed some evidence that Harvard's own internal research office, the Office of Institutional Research, had produced a number of reports to the admissions office employing statistical analysis And it itself had found and reported to the director of admissions that Asian Americans were disadvantaged by Harvard's application process, that there were negative effects for some groups, and the only group for which there was a negative effect was for Asian Americans. And there was even internal correspondence that Harvard's admissions office should be very careful about sharing these numbers outside the university because of the negative effects on some groups. The actual statistical information that was produced in the litigation to the experts, I think, sort of refined and bore out those internal findings. Both sides retained experts, economist experts, very well-respected experts that the district court credited, both sides. Peter Arcidiacono was the plaintiff's primary statistical expert. He's a professor at Duke. David Card, who's a professor at University of Cal Berkeley, was retained by Harvard. They both produced very extensive regression, statistical regression analysis. So you would control for a variety of factors and try to isolate what effect race was having in predicted admissions decisions. And that essentially bore out. There was a lot of debate. Let me just give you, I'll try to do this in 30 seconds. Harvard's basic admissions process is that once the applications come in and the readers read them, and then they essentially give conditional, recommendations to each candidate, and then the candidates are discussed in a big committee meeting with the entire admissions office, which, you know, swells to about 40 people as they decide who is in or who is out. And they basically assign five rankings. They assign a ranking for academic achievement, and you might expect there's some guidelines on what that is. And, you know, you get a one, which is the best score if you won a national academic competition or a national award while you were in high school. You get a two, depending on if you have extremely high test scores or grades or academic accomplishments. A three is kind of more a run-of-the-mill average applicant at Harvard, which, of course, is still very competitive to most American universities. And a four is someone who is substandard. There's recommended SAT ranges, and it's a fairly predictable objective set of criteria. The same is true for extracurricular. If you had achieved some kind of national extracurricular recognition, chess team or some sort of debate competition or something like that, you might get a four. A three would be for someone who is the captain of perhaps competitive extracurricular teams at their high school or regionally. A two would be a two. A three would be someone who is maybe just active in extracurricular activities at school but not particularly accomplished, and so on. There is also an athletic rating. A one was basically reserved for recruited athletes. A two is someone who was distinguished, maybe a captain of their high school athletic team. You get the same basic gist, but there were guidelines for that too. Then you come to the personal rating. And the personal rating, I think it is fair to say, was a little bit more subjective. The only guidance that was given in the written materials for a personal rating is like a one was someone who had very high personal qualities. A two was someone who had not as high personal qualities. Three was someone who had average personal qualities. When you took the depositions and you looked at the testimony as to, well, what does this personal rating mean? What you got back was, does someone have courage? Would they be a good roommate? Do they have a sense of humor? These are not the most objective criteria that one could imagine for ranking candidates, although they may be legitimate considerations when you're trying to put together a student body. And then obviously a four was someone with negative personal qualities. And then there was an overall rating, and the overall rating was what it sounds like was basically the admissions officer's view as to when you looked at the entire application, including these various categories that were ranked, should this person is one is basically an automatic admit, two is a competitive admit. A lot of the action was basically among the twos and the threes as to who might get in. And Harvard admits that it takes other things into account, too, including whether you are a legacy. If your parents went to Harvard, Harvard considers that important. If you are the child of a member of the staff or the faculty, that gets you a leg up in the Harvard admissions process. Harvard's story is that race was one factor among many that would be considered to account, and the only place where it would actually manifest itself on the application process was in the overall rating. And so there was broad agreement among the statistical experts in this case that you're trying to measure what the effect of race is in admissions process. You shouldn't use the overall rating if race is affecting the overall rating because it would distort it. You got to exclude the overall rating when you're trying to measure what the test scores, what the grades were, all the various things that go into admissions decision, because it's affected by race itself. So everyone agreed on that. What SFFA's expert found was that the personal rating itself showed very strong disparities with respect to race. And it showed it in a way that when you looked at who were the most competitive applicants to Harvard, you factor out everything else. You run a regression analysis, which, you know, assigns values to all aspects of the admissions process. And what it found was that on average, among the most competitive applicants to Harvard, the African Americans got the highest personal ratings, and Hispanic Americans got the second highest personal ratings, and white Americans got the third highest personal rating, and Asian Americans got the fourth highest personal ratings. And what's particularly interesting about that fact is it almost mirrors exactly the pattern that you see in the overall rating, which Harvard agreed was influenced by race. And the reason why this ultimately mattered, setting aside questions as to whether or not there should really be a observable difference in the personal rating. There's a dispute as to whether it's personality or personal, so let's just call it the personal rating. By race, and whether your race has anything to say about, you know, your courage, or whether you're a good roommate, or if you have a good sense of humor. There's no reason to believe that it would actually not only race would have an effect on that, but it would have the exact same effect that the overall rating, and indeed that Harvard's kind of diversity priorities would reflect. And so that suggested to at least SFFA that, well, it seems like the personal rating might be affected by race. Harvard fought that vigorously, and the reason they fought that was because at the end of the day, everybody agreed that if you excluded the personal rating from your regression analysis, just like the overall rating, both experts agreed that there was a statistically significant negative effect of being Asian American vis-a-vis white in the Harvard admissions process. And even the district court, which ultimately upheld Harvard's admissions process under existing law, found that there was disparities in the Asian admission rate based on the statistics that it could not explain, and that indeed might be the effect of either intentional discrimination or implicit bias. The last piece of evidence from trial that I think is worth commenting on here was that there was a question about race-neutral alternatives. And Rick Collenberg, who is an expert in this area, and not what I think anyone would describe as a conservative, but Rick Collenberg presented evidence on behalf of SFFA that if you were to eliminate some of the preferences that Harvard gives to alumni children and to the children of faculty and staff, and if you were to replace any racial preference with a preference based on socioeconomic status, and the size of the preference he gave here was one half the size of the preference that Harvard gives to recruited athletes. So that is a significant, you know, bump for socioeconomic status, but it is not as dramatic as it does for recruited athletes. If you gave socioeconomic disadvantage that kind of status, you could generate a class at Harvard that saw an increase in Asian representation by about 10%, an increase in Hispanic representation by 8%, Black representation in the admitted class would fall from 14 to 10%. Although that was using the most recent class at the time in the data set, which was 2019. I'll note that if you went back to 2016, the African-American representation in the admitted class at Harvard was 10%. So it would be no different than going back to, I'm sorry, I said 2016, I meant 2012. This would be for the class of 2016. And when I say 2019, I meant the class of 2019. And of course, unsurprisingly, that would also lead to a much more diverse socioeconomic class at Harvard. Harvard's class, unsurprisingly, is extremely tilted toward the wealthy. And this type of race-neutral alternative would, in fact, produce a far more balanced class that reflected a lot more of what the country looks like, at least socioeconomically, without meaningfully diminishing the academic qualities of the class. None of this, as I said, was ultimately persuasive to the district court. It found under existing precedent, despite some of the concerns it had about the statistics, that Harvard's admissions process survived strict scrutiny as set forth in Grutter, and it upheld the program. It was appealed to the First Circuit. The First Circuit affirmed the district court's decision, again, applying what it viewed as the current case law. I will note that the United States Department of Justice, which of course was under the prior administration, filed briefs on behalf of Students for Fair Admissions, agreeing that Harvard's admissions process could not survive scrutiny. I should note that although the Equal Protection Clause generally applies to state universities, when you're challenging the use of race in the admissions process, Harvard is a private university. And so the claims technically arise under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits racial discrimination in higher education. The First Circuit affirmed, and so our cert petition was filed in February of this year. We garnered 20 amicus briefs in support of certiorari. Harvard has obviously opposed certiorari, and in June, the Supreme Court called for the views of the Solicitor General. That request is still pending. If you look at past history, we would expect that the Solicitor General's views will come in sometime at the end of the year. Until the Solicitor General sort of weighs in on this brief, the position of the United States remains that Harvard's admissions process does, in fact, violate Title VI. Whether they will change that view, we can all make educated guesses on that, but we'll see when they file their actual filing. And so if that timeline holds, and again, there's no formal deadline on the Solicitor General's contribution, I would expect to see that brief come in sometime around the end of the year, and the Supreme Court will be deciding whether to grant cert on this case sometime early next year. The questions teed up for review in the Supreme Court are, one, should Grutter v. Bollinger be overruled? And we can have a talk a little bit about that as the panel goes on, as well as, under existing precedent, does Harvard's admissions process comply with Title VI and strict scrutiny as set forth in Grutter? That's my fast-talking overview of the case, but we'll be happy to revisit as we go on.
Very helpful, Patrick. Thank you. Corey, we'll turn to you.
Well, since Patrick did such a good job of describing the facts of the case and the procedural history, I kind of wanted to just share a bit on a personal level how this case has affected me, and other Asian Americans, I think, who have gone through the same experience. So my parents came to the U.S. in 1987. They came to Austin, Texas. I was born a few years afterwards. And certainly growing up as the son of immigrants and as a racial minority, that wasn't easy. Having to speak two languages at home, or, one language at home, one language at school. We spoke Chinese growing up, eating different foods, sometimes getting picked on in school and having to navigate all that. It certainly was a challenge growing up. And so, as I learned about the history of racial equality in this country, and the civil rights movement and how inspiring that was and how much change had occurred from just decades before I was born and before my parents got to this country, that's great. And I felt blessed and grateful to be in a country that protected the rights of minorities and guaranteed equal rights for everyone. When it came time to go to the college admissions process, I started to learn about this race as a factor in admissions issue. And we heard about, we're going to try to create a diverse student body and look at factors outside of your academics and all these various qualities, and we want to get to know you as a person. We also hear this language of trying to increase underrepresented minorities. And I know that, Asians are only 6% of the population, and really that's such a broad category. If you're talking about people who are Chinese, that may be like 1%. So in my mind, I was thinking, if we exceed 1% or 6%, does that mean I'm not underrepresented? If I'm not underrepresented, and the purpose of this policy is to increase the numbers for folks who are underrepresented, then how is my race being used? Is it going to be used negatively against me? I think a lot of Asian Americans had this lingering question in the back of their minds. But if you'd called up the university and asked them to explain, they would say, everyone has an equal opportunity and we treat everyone as an individual. If you talk to the college admissions counselors, I did one of these Federalist Society talks with Anna Ivey, one of the sort of high profile admissions advice gurus who's written books on this subject. She'll say, everyone, they treat everyone as an individual and your race You're, as Harvard said at trial, your race can only help you. It can never hurt you. But of course, that's logically impossible. If it's going to increase numbers of some races, what's going to happen to the students who don't belong to those races? So these were questions we always asked, but because the media never really gave voice to them, and the Supreme Court and all the courts that had decided these cases never really gave voice to them, we're sort of in this, I don't know, I guess gaslighting kind of feeling, like we know we're experiencing something that we know is discrimination, that our race, that they're looking at our race and it's being used against us, but there's no one out there to even talk to about it or to, just to hear it to validate that this is true. If you read the opinions in Grutter and in Fisher, there was no talk about Asian Americans, at least until the 2016 Fisher opinion when Justice Alito dissented. So throughout my whole life, there was nothing in the court records talking about this issue when this issue had been litigated, talking about how Asian Americans were, how we even existed, let alone how we were affected. And so that kind of started this quest to want to find other people. Who can I talk to about this? What is really going on here? And I think that is what this Harvard lawsuit has exposed. Because you would always raise the concern of discrimination, and there was basically, it was like one Princeton study that had some actual numbers, and then the other side, the defenders of the policy, would say, well, that's not entirely accurate, and once you look at the big picture, we don't really know anything. But this lawsuit has revealed an unprecedented amount of data about how this actually works in practice, at least at Harvard. But also some information about some of the other Ivy League schools, because they do coordinate. One of the facts that came out was that they all go to this conference and they all share their racial numbers halfway through the admissions process, so they can all get to keep tabs on where each other are, which is one of the ways they achieve almost perfect racial composition year after year for decades. But we see in raw data how these, you know, racial numbers really affect it. And what's perhaps most stunning is this internal report that Harvard did examining this exact question. So this question had been raised before. They became aware of it. They did a study, and it found that this is from the Harvard Crimson, their kind of headline describing this report when it came out in the litigation. Internal Harvard review showed disadvantage for Asian applicants. And of course, the litigation through discovery, we produced years of admissions data that was redacted, but we got this unprecedented look into this private university's admissions process. And so what they found was that if you had only looked at academics, Asians could be 43% of the student body at Harvard. And that once you consider extracurricular and personal factors, that number decreased significantly. And the district court focused on that, but what's misleading there is this is extracurricular and personal. Actually, the district court's findings of fact found that Asian Americans had the highest extracurricular performances. That's on page 55 of the district court slip opinion. And so really, the extracurriculars helped Asians, so it was this personal rating that was affecting them. And so what we're seeing is our worst fears confirmed. And you know, because this has been kind of a quest for me ever since I applied to college more than a decade ago, I decided to go watch the last couple of days of the Harvard trial. It was a 3-week trial. And when I went there, I saw more Asian American journalists than I had ever seen anywhere. And it was clear that this was a historic moment, that this was giving voice to this concern and story that hadn't been told. And what you saw were Asian American writers who were not necessarily conservative or never had expressed many views on this issue before, but they were starting to echo concerns. They said, this data is validating something we've kind of felt all along. So I'm just gonna read a couple of these articles that came out. The first one is Jeannie Sook Gerson. She's a professor at Harvard Law School. She's Korean American. I'll just read the first opening paragraph. The application process for schools, fellowships, and jobs always came with a ritual. A person who had a role in choosing me, an admissions officer and interviewer, would mention in his congratulations that I was different from the other Asians. When I won a scholarship that paid for part of my education, a selection panelist told me that I got it because I had moving qualities of heart and originality that Asian applicants generally lacked. Asian applicants were all so alike, and I stood out. In truth, I wasn't much different from other Asians I knew. I was shy and reticent, played a musical instrument, spent summers drilling math, and had strict parents to whom I was dutiful. But I got the message. To be allowed through a narrow door, an Asian should cultivate not just a sense of individuality, but also ways to project not like other Asians. Here's another one. This is from Slate, Aaron Mack. He actually says he has some sympathies for these policies, but at the same time, he writes this rather lengthy, probably the most powerful article I've read that echoed what I experienced going through the admissions process. It's called The Price of Admission. I'll just read this excerpt. Like many other high school seniors, I carefully manicured my identity to cater to the admissions committee. But that effort also involved erasing it in order to appear white, or at least less Asian. That's one of the facts that's coming out in this litigation, that it's actually harder to get in as an Asian than a white student because they're overrepresented. I chose to leave the optional race and ethnicity section of the form blank, a practice common among Asian applicants. I assumed Mac isn't a popularly known Chinese surname in the US. My dad used to jokingly point out that it's one letter off from the Gaelic surname, Mac, with a K, or with a C. Maybe an oblivious admissions officer would mistake me for Scottish. I didn't tell my father how much I'd hoped our family name would be misread. I marked my intended major as philosophy, thinking this was one of those impractical fields that most sensible Asian parents would not allow their children to pursue. I had no intention of actually following through. I avoided participating in the Future Doctors Association, Ping Pong Club, Robotics Team, and the Asian Culture Group. I quit piano, viewing the instrument as a totem of my race's overeager striving in America. I opted to spend much of my time writing plays and film reviews, pursuits I genuinely did find rewarding, but which I also chose so I wouldn't be pigeonholed. I enrolled in a Mandarin course during my senior year of high school, never having learned a Chinese dialect as a kid, but I dropped it a few weeks in. I told people it was because I was too busy, but in actuality, I didn't want Mandarin on my transcript and as a second language on my application, which I feared could be a red flag for the admissions committee. There's a, in the history of this, you know, there was a FOIA dispute that ultimately led to some documents coming out from Princeton University through an investigation of the Department of Education that had similar concerning statements found in the admissions file. They said basically, you know, this is just another textureless math grind, another Asian. So you're seeing in written comments, folks at Princeton who were evaluating Asians, like, yeah, there's just so many Asians. All they do is study. Right, they don't have any personalities. Oh, hey, look, here's someone who can write poetry, right? I mean, you could see those stereotypes, and I think they're probably a little more savvy now with the litigation to avoid writing those things down. But unfortunately, this litigation has confirmed our fears, but it also has been empowering to finally hear our story told. You know, as I've learned as I've become a litigator and you know, you can lose a case sometimes, and your client will still really appreciate what you've done because they know that you did the right thing, you told that story, and you made their voice heard in this process. I'm hopeful that the Supreme Court will grant this case and that they will finally actually discuss how these policies affect Asians instead of using the word minority to refer to Black and Hispanic students and not even acknowledging that Asians exist, as Justice Sotomayor did in her dissent in the 2014 Michigan affirmative action ban case, that will finally be acknowledged. And I don't know what the Supreme Court is going to do. I hope they grant the case, and I hope they acknowledge that these policies have harms, regardless of whether they end up ruling for Harvard or for the Students for Fair Admissions. But you know, I'm reminded of what Adam Mortara said in the closing arguments at the Harvard trial when I went there to watch. He said, the history books will show that there was discrimination against Asians at Harvard. We've established that through the facts that have come out in this case. The only question is whether the courts did anything about it. And so I think regardless of what the Supreme Court does, even if they reject the case, I think that the dissents that come out of that will nonetheless tell that story, and it will go down in history as an unfortunate, shameful decision if that happens. And I think because of this lawsuit, many Asian Americans have discovered their voice and will continue to raise these concerns and to press these issues. And it's not going to go away because it's a fundamental instability in this policy that hasn't been talked about enough. In all the debates that I watched growing up, it just was not a primary focus. So I think I just want to say thank you to Patrick and Will Consovoy and all the other too many people to name who have pressed this case all the way from 2014 to this day to finally. I've never seen as many Asian American journalists of all persuasions, whether it for or against the policy, have an opportunity to make their voice heard and to write about their own experiences as Asian Americans as a result of this lawsuit. So I want to thank you for what you're doing, and you know, we'll see what the Supreme Court does.
Thank you, Corey. Professor Shaw, we'll turn to you for the final portion of our remarks before we open this up to discussion among the panel.
Well, first, let me thank you for inviting me once again to a Federal Society event about which I have said many times I have strongly mixed feelings every time I come. Sometimes I'm a piñata. Sometimes I leave feeling like it was a good and worthwhile discussion and debate. Sometimes I leave with my blood boiling. And so I don't know how I'll leave here today. I will say, Patrick, that I appreciate your presentation. Corey, I appreciate especially your presentation. And I want to think about some more about Corey, what you said. Some of what I say, though, will certainly, on all probability, not be well received. Let me start with this. Behind these lawsuits, I'm talking about the Harvard lawsuit now, the UNC suit, the two Fisher cases, and other challenges to race-conscious attempts to keep the doors of opportunity open. Notice how I frame that. Some of you will disagree with that. I strongly disagree with the language of preferences because it's the end of the conversation when you start there. Preferences seem to me to be applicable to people who are on the same starting point with respect to opportunity. And then you put your finger on the scale in an unfair way to one of the people involved in the race. That's not what the struggle to open the doors of opportunities, at least on behalf of African Americans, in this country, nowadays, Latinos, Latinx people have been included in that struggle. Frankly, the issues of Asian Americans are much more complex than this discourse suggests, in my view. In fact, all these issues are very complex. With respect to Asian Americans, complexities can be referenced by simply saying it's one thing, with all due respect, to be a Korean American, a Japanese American, a Chinese American in this country. It's another thing to be somebody who came from Cambodia or Vietnam, some of these communities, very complex. But one thing is clear, in my view, and Corey, I want to just offer this thought, and as I said, think more about what you said, and I'm happy to engage in some one-on-one conversation about this, too. The thing about people who immigrated to this country from many of the Asian countries in recent years, yeah, I think about New York City and Stuyvesant High School. I know you know about Stuyvesant High School, or I assume you know about it. Many of you may know about it. Maybe some of you don't. Stuyvesant High School, the viewed as the top public high school in New York City. Admission on one factor, and one factor only, a standardized test. You go to standardized test makers and you ask them whether that's appropriate if you push them. If you don't push them, they won't say anything about it because they're going to the bank on standardized tests. But they'll acknowledge that it's inappropriate to use standardized tests as the sole factor in admissions. In Stuyvesant High School, a very large Asian American presence, close to zero with respect to African American presence. I have to acknowledge African Americans don't perform as well on standardized tests as Asian Americans, as white Americans. Before white Americans begin to feel good about that, let me just say, Asian Americans outperform white Americans on standardized tests. Let me throw something else in the mix. Look at admissions to Harvard, to Yale, to UNC, to major universities around the country. I happened to see the statistics at Harvard in a pie chart I was looking at last night with respect to gender. Women and men just about equal. Women are outperforming men academically in this country. There is a thumb on the scale to try to produce diversity with respect to the presence of men at many universities. And very few people find that objectionable or talking about it or acknowledging it. If you doubt me about it, just Google it. There's some articles in the New York Times recently. Here's the point that I'm trying to make, albeit maybe clumsily. This country is still struggling with a long and ugly history when it comes to its African-American citizens. People who come to America looking for opportunity, I get it. This is the land of opportunity, or it's supposed to be. But the opportunity issues in this country with respect to race have not been resolved. It's still on the table. So when one comes to this country from another country, it may be hard to realize that the things that you learned about, Corey, when you came to this country with respect to the history of the civil rights struggle, are not just history. These issues continue. They're still on the table. A word about what's behind these cases. Ed Blum has an agenda, and I'm not going to dance around it. Ed Blum is the same individual who was behind the lawsuit that was aimed at striking down one of the most important parts of the Voting Rights Act. And he succeeded in Shelby County versus Holder. And as a consequence, we see, and I know this is not about voting rights, but if you understand the dynamic in this country, we see now that much of what many jurisdictions were unable to do, or was harder for them to do with respect to discrimination against people of color and electoral and democratic participation, it was at least under the watch of the Justice Department, under the watch of the federal courts in jurisdictions with a history of discrimination. That mechanism has been struck down. Ed Blum was behind that. He's behind his issue. I'll say it straight up front, and folks can disagree with me. One of the reasons I'm here is because I still believe it's important to talk with people with whom I disagree. But I believe deeply, in fact, I know that what is driving Ed Blum's agenda has not been Asian Americans, with all due respect. That's not to say that there aren't any issues with respect to admissions and Asian Americans. But what drives Ed Blum is an attack on efforts to open up opportunities, whether they're in higher education or whether they're in political participation, for black folks. And that continues today. Straight up, I'm saying that that's his agenda. And the genius of Ed Blum, I say, reluctantly, is that he's figured out how to do this by putting another set of issues on the table so that it's not a black-white agenda. Let me say, if you look at these statistics with respect to race and Harvard University, I think that the statistics for black presence at the in the undergraduate level is somewhere around 5 or 6%. I think that's right. The presence of Asian Americans is somewhere around, I think, 21%. White Americans, much lower than it has been historically, but somewhere around 42-43%. You can't blame or assign any loss of opportunity for white students at Harvard on African Americans, because even if you get rid of all the African Americans at Harvard, you'll still find that the white presence at Harvard has decreased. The country is changing. And that's what's been driving a good deal of the politics of the country. You know, January 6th and other issues. By the way, I can't resist saying this. Forgive me. I'm still waiting for, at some point, the Federalist Society to say, we've heard enough of you. You know, we're not inviting you back anymore. And when that day comes, you know, I will take it in stride. But when I
motion
saw...
Motion denied.
But when I saw that this afternoon you have on the agenda, you know, critical race theory, I just shook my head. I actually did more than that. But, you know, that's, you know, for me, it's like saying that we're going to put on the agenda of the Federalist Society or anybody else the question of whether we should be teaching grade school students, you know, law and economics. Nobody's teaching critical race theory to children. What people are talking about is race, but that's not critical race theory. I just couldn't resist saying that. I could say much more about that. But this is part of a political process aimed at the discourse about race and racial equality. So look, let me close by saying this. I see you, Judge. I've been deeply involved in these issues for all of my professional career. I was at the Supreme Court on the day that Bakke was decided. Bakke for black Americans was a loss. And if I hadn't used up all my time saying other things, I would talk about why that's so. If anybody's interested, I invite those questions. But the diversity rationale that Justice Powell came up with was a rationale that may have incidentally, keep the doors of opportunity open to many African Americans and other people of color. But the original rationale was not diversity. And there's a lot of misunderstanding even on the Supreme Court today. Justice Alito, in an exchange he engaged in with the lawyer for the University of Texas in the Fisher case, made very clear, with all due respect to him, I don't think he understands diversity as a rationale. I've been in this a long time. I was in the Michigan case. I was one of the people who helped to draft the admissions policy or redraft the admissions policy of the University of Michigan. And could talk much about that. Was lead counsel for Black and Latino interviews in, or interveners rather, in the undergraduate case in Michigan. So there's a whole lot to say, but this last word that I have on this is this. Justice O'Connor, 25 years, when she said 25 years, we won't need this any longer, I knew at the moment that came out of her mouth, when she uttered those words, that with all due respect to Justice O'Connor, that she was not only mistaken, but didn't have what appeared to me to be a good grasp on the complexities of race and our history of race in this country. But to her credit, she wrote an article that maybe some of you read not long after the Michigan case Grutter was decided, aided by one of her former law clerks, in which she made clear that 25 years was not a deadline. She didn't mean it to be a deadline. When we talk about that as a deadline, we talk in ignorance with respect to the task still before us to do anything like accomplishing racial equity and equality in this country, which, yes, Corey, is even more difficult now. Actually, it's always been difficult. This has never been a biracial country, but it's even more difficult because we have people who have come to this country at a time when there's already a discussion, a national discussion, an agenda underway. That's just the way it is. It's complex.
Professor, thank you. If I'm confident of anything, it's that you've bought yourself another decade of FedSoc service with your
I hope not.
With your comments this morning. Thank you. Thank you, as always, for your contribution. So let's open this up now to some dialogue among the panel. And I want to start by picking up on something that Professor Shaw mentioned, which is this concept of starting blocks, sometimes referred to as equity in popular parlance. And Patrick, maybe you could take this one. One of the criticisms that is obviously raised in this litigation and in commentary about the litigation is, well, what happens if there is an unequal starting point for applicants to admissions to elite institutions or to any institutions for that matter? And we remove the kinds of preferences or considerations, to use different language, that may be given by these institutions. Well, what will happen to the student population? In other words, if we're no longer using race as a factor, what will happen to the applicants and the classes that they compose? So maybe you could comment on that.
Sure. Let me start by doing the obligatory move of any panelist, which is to immediately shift to a different question than the one I was just asked. But I'll get.
It's as if that happens in court, too. I've
noticed. Never before you, Judge Mady. Let me just say, I agree wholeheartedly with a number of things that Professor Shaw said. I certainly agree that these are complex issues and that they're not easy to pigeonhole or to button down into simple slogans. I also fiercely agree that we need to be able to talk, we need to be able to disagree, we need to be able to talk with people who disagree with us, and that if you have an idea that cannot withstand discussion, debate, even shared perspectives by people who had a different experience than you, then your idea is not worth very much and it will not stand very long on its own merits. So I 100% appreciate with that. I also disagree with some of the things Professor Shaw said, including, I suppose, his view as to Edward Blum, who is a officer at Students for Fair Admissions, but is certainly not the only person who shares Students for Fair Admissions goal and agenda. I mean, having had the benefit of knowing and speaking to Edward Blum, I will say that he is very passionate about the idea that race has too big of an effect in governmental action in this country and that we should go away from it. And I don't think that his commitment to that idea stems from anything other than his view as to what is right and what is required by the United States Constitution and federal law. And I don't think that, you know, I mean, Edward Blum has put forward, you know, I guess he can speak for himself and he doesn't need me to defend him. But this litigation advocates for a number of measures that Harvard could and should or consider, at least consider adapting, that would not benefit, for example, white Americans. Eliminating legacy admissions at Harvard University would not be to the benefit of white applicants to Harvard University, thanks to its long history of favoring white applicants in its admissions process. So, like, there's nothing beyond his desire other than, I think, you know, what he says on his surface, which is that we have documents and we have an understanding. And I think this is a legitimate subject for debate, but there is certainly a lot of room on the side of good faith views that that the use of race by the government is something that is different, and we should reconsider whether it's achieving even the goals that its proponents say it should. But we can have a long talk about that, and I'm sure that there will be plenty of opportunities to do so. Back to the specific question, what happens? Well, that's really an open question, because all that these lawsuits ask, at least if you look at the question of overturning Grutter, is that race not be one of the things used in the holistic admissions process. Nothing in this lawsuit or in the remedies requested by SFFA would stop a university from continuing to employ holistic admissions. Nothing would require them to use a standardized test as their only feature for admission. Nothing would require universities to cease using any other efforts that they want to achieve diversity writ large. And indeed, Rick Collenberg presented a number of alternatives available to Harvard, and which I think are fairly available to a lot of universities, including the use of socioeconomic disadvantage as a factor that would not touch upon, you know, what we view as Title VI and the Equal Protection Clause as forbidding, which is the use of race, but would manage to ensure that, in fact, a more racially diverse coalition of students would be admitted to Harvard. I guess the only other thing that I would add on that is that this conversation, by its nature, loses a lot of its nuance. And just as there may well be differences between the experience of a Hmong or a Vietnamese refugee who comes to the United States, so is there also a vast difference between, for example, the African American son of doctors and lawyers versus the African American son of working class people, or a recent immigrant from Nigeria, for that matter. Those people all have very different experiences, and I would suggest to you that it's not clear to me that the current license to use race in the admissions process is recognizing the individuality of those decisions. Indeed, there was at least statistical evidence in the Harvard case that you did not gain any greater advantage from being African-American and low-income in the Harvard admissions process than you did from being African-American and high-income. In other words, the value that was assigned to your increased, the value of increased probability of admission by dint of your race was so large that it essentially made your economic status meaningless, at least with respect to African-American male applicants. So that's just something to think about. I guess my answer is, I think you could still have a very diverse class at these universities, and I do not doubt, the one thing I'm very confident of, is I do not doubt that if the universities were told that they could not use race, that they would still not give up the desire to introduce diverse classes year after year, and I believe that they would leave no stone unturned to ensure that universities do not become white or Asian monoliths. So I'm confident in that fact.
So, Patrick, and I invite you to have a conversation about Ed Blum sometime if you'd like to. Certainly I don't begin to understand how one could say that his motivations in attacking the Voting Rights Act, particularly given what we see has happened, which was entirely predictable, after one of the crucial parts of that act was declared unconstitutional. He knows what he's doing, and he has a reason for doing it. And I don't think it's simply to say that there's that the government should never consider race. Let me shift, though, because you came to something that I alluded to before, about which I do agree with you. But it was, I referenced it when I said something about Justice Alito and an exchange in the Fisher case. Justice Alito said to the lawyer arguing for the university, I don't see how the son or the daughter of a black doctor or lawyer, you know, well off, certainly, economically, I don't see why they should be the beneficiary of a diversity, or maybe he said affirmative action, I don't remember. It does matter. But he didn't get it. And what I thought was, that goes right back to what I alluded to when I talked about Bakke and Powell and the original rationale for what was once called affirmative action, which was to address the continuing legacy, the intergenerational effects of the slavery to Jim Crow continuum in this country, and to open doors of opportunity. But the remedial rationale, that's what that is, to remedy that history, was killed by Bakke, all but killed. And what was left was Justice Powell's diversity rationale. But if diversity is the only rationale left available to open doors of opportunity to those who have been excluded historically, then the argument that, or the observation, justices don't argue except with themselves, but the only observation that he had, I think, shows that he doesn't quite grasp, with all due respect, what the diversity argument is, or the rationale is, because the black son or daughter of a lawyer or a doctor does bring diversity to an institution, is different from other students in some ways. So if diversity is the rationale, you got to live with that fact, and think about diversity writ large. One other thing, I agree with you about socioeconomic inequality and diversity in this country. Many white, poor, and working class people do not get access to these opportunities at the Harvards of the world or other universities. And I think we should be fighting to open the doors of opportunity for them too. Having said that, though, it's also true that if you have class-conscious, colorblind policies in admissions, most of the beneficiaries of those policies are going to be white, because most of the people who are economically disadvantaged in this country, even though black and brown people are disproportionately economically disadvantaged, most of the people disadvantaged are white. As I said, I think we ought to be fighting to keep the doors open for them. But I'm also fighting to keep the doors open for black and brown people in this country who historically have been discriminated against.
And Corey, let me pivot to you on that point. So would you argue for or against other affirmative action style policies that perhaps don't take race into consideration? And this touches upon something that Patrick mentioned as well, policies that give a benefit to children of alumni, legacy recruits. Yeah. Your views on those questions?
So I first of all, on the legacy alumni preference, I think it's just downright corrupt. It's a way for private universities to enhance their power. And quite frankly, I think they use their racial diversity agenda as a way to sort of cover up for what is obviously a preference for privileged children. So I think, you know, if I was a member of Congress, I'd defund universities who use those practices if I could. As for socioeconomic, I think that is a potentially a legitimate rationale. Let me distinguish. We've been talking about diversity and then opening doors of opportunity, which I think are two different things, right? Opening doors of opportunity means recognizing people who have not had as much advantage as other people, people who started from more difficult circumstances. Diversity has more of this, and I think this is actually through these conversations I've had with various professors, you, Professor Shaw, Professor Kennedy, it actually seems to be a point of agreement, which is that the diversity rationale is flawed, because it's almost as if we're going to a buffet and I want to try a little bit of everything. And really, that's almost kind of a white-centric view of the benefits of diversity, in that, you know, the white student is probably going to be the most likely one who has not encountered people of other races, whereas racial minorities every day have to navigate their home culture and then this dominant majority culture that doesn't really understand them as well. So I think that is a point of agreement. So I think I've come down fundamentally against the diversity rationale. I actually talked with Professor Levinson at the University of Texas, and he wrote an article on this, which said basically, you cannot capture every form of diversity. I mean, the way his example that he used to illustrate it was, he wanted to see more Muslim students, but that just didn't, in terms of the hierarchy of identities that they were prioritizing, it just didn't make it on the list. And so there's no way to do diversity that doesn't end up ultimately excluding some people and prioritizing other groups. And it's, there's an arbitrariness to it. But I do think opening doors of opportunity is a legitimate concern, certainly, especially for a state university, I think, where elected officials have to consider their constituents. I also do think there is a role for a, whatever you want to call it, academically elite kind of university, and that that presents its own benefits for a society and for those students. So I guess I'm kind of agnostic. I think that there's room for you both approaches to admissions. I just don't think race should belong there, because it does impose a unique dignitary harm on those who end up checking a race and realizing that that becomes a disadvantage for them.
Let me just respond to two points there, if I could, both made by Professor Shaw and by Corey. One of them is that on the point about socioeconomic preferences and who would they actually benefit. I mean, the evidence, at least with respect to the Harvard applicant pool, was that using a socioeconomic preference, eliminating the use of race as a preference, using a socioeconomic preference, and then eliminating what we've talked about before, the bumps that Harvard gives to legacy students and the children of faculty and staff and donors, would actually result in a class at Harvard that was less white, and this would maintain Harvard's, you know, academic standards. It would not result in a disproportionate benefit to, you know, less well-off white students. It would increase the number of Asian Americans. It would massively increase the number of Hispanic Americans, and it would lead to a decline in African American representation that, like I said, only goes back to just a few years before roughly the time the lawsuit was filed. So I don't think that it would be so significant of a step backwards, and that would just be in the short term. One might imagine that there are ways in which both the applicant pool and the universities could explore other ways, and that might have the effect of increasing racial diversity while also increasing socioeconomic diversity and diversity writ large, a lot of these different experiences that we're talking about the value. With respect to the diversity rationale, I mean, this is sort of, I mean, there is a world in which perhaps in Bakke or in Grutter that the court could have taken a broader view as to what is a compelling governmental interest, and perhaps some sort of restorative justice vision or some idea to correct some sort of societal legacy of discrimination could well have been accepted as a justification for the use of race. But the court, you know, like it or not, has not accepted any rationale other than the diversity rationale. And the question now before the court is whether that rationale is still good. It seems like there's some agreement on all sides here that rationale is not particularly compelling, and I suppose whether it should be replaced with a different rationale. But at least with respect to litigating this case in part under the current rubric, that's the only permissible use of race, at least in this context, that's allowed. And
you know, in Bakke, when I said that it was a loss for African Americans, it was a loss for many reasons I haven't laid out here. But one of the things that Justice Powell and four other justices said was that institutions could not try to remedy the present effects of historical discrimination in our society unless it's discrimination that they themselves cause. So, in other words, the court, a majority of the court, and the court still is there in a majority, apparently, wrings its hands about our history of discrimination and the present day effects, and then washes its hands of it. I thought, maybe naively for a moment, when we were engaged in our discussion about class, about the diversity rationale, I thought maybe there was a little sliver of light to try to talk about some common ground. But then I saw that close. And the reason is because if you say we can't pursue diversity, and I've been a critic in some ways of diversity, but I fought for it as a second best alternative. But we can't do anything that is race conscious. Race consciousness is equated with racism, which is a false equation. And then we can't do anything about it. That's like a physician diagnosing an illness and saying we cannot remedy that illness because in order to do so, we have to maybe use an antibody. You know, we have to be conscious in this case of race in order to remedy the legacy of racial discrimination. That's a false equation. It's not an honest discourse with all due respect. And we will never, ever be able to get to a point that people say they want to reach, which is colorblindness. I'm not interested in colorblindness. The issue isn't whether we are conscious of color. The question is, what is the significance of that consciousness? Is it a matter for oppressing people, denying people opportunities, subordinating people? Or do we see it and then use our consciousness of it to bring about some more equality? We're not on the same page on that, because the evil, in my view, isn't race itself. It's racism.
I want to be mindful of the clock, and we are coming up towards the end of our panel. So I do want to open this up to comments and questions from the audience. It's a small enough room that we think we could probably do it without coming to the mic. If you want to definitely be heard, we'll let you come up. We'll start over here on the left side.
Professor Shaw raises an important point procedurally. The question that I have, and it really has to do with standing. When the Supreme Court wants to avoid dealing with a controversial substantive issue, they decide a case on standing. And my question is, associational standing here. If the court were to find that the organ, I don't know much about your plaintiff here, and when it was created, but it appears that the other side, at least, is concerned that it was created just to litigate the case. And so if that is, in fact, the case, and the Supreme Court might challenge you on that point, I'd like to hear you comment a little bit about that, as opposed to an organization that's existed for years and, you know, pursues a case.
Okay. So let me just say, if it's not legitimate to create a voluntary membership organization to promote litigation, I have very bad news for the ACLU, among others. But I don't think that the vintage of the voluntary association is particularly relevant, thank goodness, because we all have neighborhood groups and other, you know, grassroots litigation entities or entities that at least envision potential litigation, and they shouldn't have to exist for a certain period of time before they're given standing in courts. But fortunately, I don't think that's really going to be an issue in this case. I mean, one always has those concerns. This is actually very similar to the Parents Involved case, which involved a challenge to a racial preference plan in K through 12 schools. There was another Parents Involved itself was a voluntary membership organization. It successfully fought off a standing challenge at the Supreme Court. SFFA itself easily qualifies under existing precedent as a voluntary association. You don't have to take my word on that. You can take the word of the three different district courts to have litigated this case, including the one district court that obviously found against us on the merits. They all standing was raised in a separate motion in all of those cases, and all of those courts had no trouble determining that SFFA qualified as a voluntary membership organization with standing. So. You know, I'm not in the business of predicting what the Supreme Court might do. Harvard barely mentioned standing in its brief in response. So, and for good reason. I mean, voluntary membership organizations are used by all sides of the political spectrum to assert their goals. And I don't think it would be in anyone's interest to suddenly determine that all of those organizations somehow can't engage in those activities. So. To answer the question, I don't think it'll be a problem.
May I make a quick point?
Please.
But here's an irony, and it's an irony that is one of the losses for black folks in Bakke. You know who's not present in the Supreme Court in oral argument or in anything but a marginalized way in the Supreme Court considerations because they're relegated only to amicus briefs? Black and brown people. White folks suing white-controlled institutions in cases challenging diversity, and black and brown folks not at the table. When we've asked for participation in oral arguments, I can tell you about that. It's been denied. That's a great irony in this discussion.
I would slightly disagree with that. There were a number of students who expressed an interest in defending the use of racial preferences at Harvard, and although they were given their motion to intervene was denied, they were in fact given time at trial, and they presented testimony by students, by themselves, and by other students, as well as expert, professors, and offered testimony. So they were very much heard at trial. In the UNC case, they were actually granted intervention status, and they participated in full at the trial. And I guess finally I'd say is that there is a multiplicity of views among all groups. And so I actually think that there are people of all races who have and will make their voice heard in this case on both sides of the question.
Let me be clear what I'm talking about, though, because that's true. Well, those are still marginalized ways, and you know what I mean. It's one thing to be a party. It's another thing to be even an intervener, but, you know, we can argue that point. But look at all of the Supreme Court cases, and we don't know whether the court will accept it, all of the Supreme Court cases since Bakke involving issues of race in so-called reverse discrimination challenges, and I challenge you to look at them and see where black folks are at the table arguing as full parties, arguing in the Supreme Court. You won't find it. And if you do, I will apologize for being wrong. I challenge you to find it.
Another question, here in the center.
Thank you all for coming in, especially you, Professor Shaw. It's never easy to be the minority voice in a room.
No pun intended.
This question's always for you, Patrick. So we've seen the UC system already eliminate the use of SATs in the wake of California's referendum upholding a ban on racial considerations. So I imagine if the Supreme Court grants cert and the governing law is changed, more colleges will just do that. And they won't have as many objective measures for lawyers to go in and say, oh, well, you know, this group has this SATs, or this group has this SATs, but they're getting unequal outcomes. So I guess my question is, can we ever get out from under this? Because can't universities always just remove objective considerations from their admissions process? And then if you just made everything based on the personal rating, how would you litigate that kind of case and say, well, race is illegally coming into play?
So obviously one can't predict what all universities might do. One could also agree that there is certainly value in achieving a change in what is legally or not legally permissible, whether or not that it can ever be effective to root out all types of racial discrimination. And I think people of good faith can disagree as to whether or not eliminating standardized testing is a benefit to any particular group of applicants or not. The answer, of course, is like, no, there could always be some sort of harder to root out discrimination that takes place, even if the Supreme Court were to declare that race should not be used in the college admissions process. And thankfully, there are a lot of watchdog organizations out there that will ensure that institutions, the cases may be harder to prove and they may be more difficult to litigate, but that does not mean that people will not still want to push that. There's also institutional priorities and desires not to disobey the law. And indeed, it is those same kind of institutions that I think have managed to ensure that the Voting Rights Act is still very much a topic of discussion in courthouses across the United States. So in other words, the answer to your question is it's always possible. It's hard to say what choice will be taken, and people can have a lot of disagreements on that. But I don't think it either devalues the an effort to change the existing law or to at least force universities to adopt new strategies and new policies.
Here, back of the room.
Trying to get my comment out in 30 seconds and ask you to comment on my comment. There's 330 million Americans. My own, I doubt that there's 5 million of Americans that really care about the admission standards at our elite universities. But this politics of grievance, I mean, it's just consuming the nation. And I can see we're going to get, you know, after the, I'm thinking of the decision in the Michigan case and Texas, we're just going to get more of this politics of grievance. And you know, even if we eliminated the legacy admissions, it just adds to the grievance from these people, you know, the elite. Can anybody see my point that just fuels this politics of grievance?
So I understand the spirit in which you say that, I think. I take it at good faith. But I also point out to people, my students but others, that in this country, many of our most contentious issues, and they are contentious, they are resolved in the courts. I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, if we could resolve them some other ways, it'd be a better thing. But, you know, I hope we continue, for the most part, even though there are some people apparently these days who want to depart from this, I hope that we continue to resolve our issues, however contentious they are, in the courts, as opposed to shooting each other in the streets, killing each other, engaging in violence. I'm concerned about the January 6s, not as much about having people having their voices in the courts to resolve these differences.
It's an excellent point. Maybe, Corey, if you could pick up on that. Looking at this holistically, do you see this as a question of litigation for the courts to solve, a question of policy for the legislative and elected branches to pursue, or something that pivots between?
I'm open to all avenues, but I do think this is uniquely suited for judicial resolution. And I'm actually in favor of the politics of grievance in this case, because I think this is about making the voices of Asian Americans heard in a way that they have never been in the entire history of this country. And so we can talk about inviting all the other different groups in, but I quite frankly think that would be crowding out the folks who are the plaintiffs in this case, which is Asian Americans who have never been heard on this issue before, have never even been acknowledged so much as existing in any of the Supreme Court's precedents. And I think it would be taking the oxygen away from their legitimate grievances by opening the door to different questions. Sorry, that's what it, remind me, what was the question? Resolution, right. So I've thought about this. For example, the University of Texas, right? We already have an equal protection clause in the Texas Constitution. We already have anti-discrimination laws on the book. I believe that those laws compel equal treatment and that Asians have a legitimate grievance under those laws, and yet the universities do not obey the law, in my view. So I think, what are you going to do? Pass a new law that says don't discriminate on the basis of race? We already have that as the law. So I think this is an instance of where the law is already established. We just need a court order holding them liable for violating the law.
The best conversations are the ones you don't want to end. And regrettably, we've already exceeded our time. So it is my duty to unfortunately end this now by thanking Corey, Patrick, and Ted for this exceptional conversation. And like all good conversations, this should be the beginning and not the end. So of course, I know the panelists and I will welcome your questions and thoughts throughout the day. And on behalf of the panel, thank you to the Federal Society for putting on this program this morning.
Judge, good evening.